You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's a bad time to be a man. At least that's what Hannah Rosin says in her new book, The End of Men. In it, she cites statistics and tells stories that reveal just how significantly many men's incomes and their psyches have suffered in the current economic downturn, and looks at how women have rushed in to fill the void. In her review in the LA Times on Sunday, Carolyn Kellogg wrote that Ms. Rosin's book may be the most insightful and readable cultural analysis of the year. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Hannah Rosin, who is a senior editor at The Atlantic, back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Now, that is a provocative title. It sounds like something Andrea Dworkin or Jermaine Greer would have chosen to top their books. But this is, your intention is more social commentary than feminist manifesto.
Yes. I mean, I'm in good company here. But the book is, in fact, not a manifesto, despite its cover and the fact that it looks like I'm planting a road sign, which I am planting a road sign, but I want us to debate around it. This is more just a cultural analysis. I'm telling you what is. I'm not telling you what should be, or, you know, that this is like a wonderful feminist triumph, because I think many of the stories in the book are pretty sad to look at, and you see the women exhausted and not having the help of the men. So it's not all positive, but it just is.
Women falling asleep in elevators.
Yes, exactly. Like, there's one story I tell of being in a community college, and these days community colleges are almost 70% women, and these are women who are taking care of their kids, going to work, going to school all at the same time. So between the first and the eighth floor of the elevator, this woman fell asleep and I had to wake her up.
You point out that men have been much harder hit than women by the country's economic downturn. Three quarters of the 8 million jobs lost in the recent recession were lost by men. Is it your contention that the recession has both revealed and accelerated an economic shift that's been going on for a while now?
Yes, we've had a series of recessions which has uncovered something. And what it's uncovered is that women are having an easier time adapting to the new economy than men. And so what I try, and show in the book is how that's affected our lives, our marriages, all the things that we do, and how we can navigate the new world, basically.
Now, earlier this year, it shifted for a little bit, and more men were getting jobs than women for a time. And people said that was a kind of a correction. But you suggest here that some of this stuff is just structural, that many of the men were working in construction, manufacturing, and the finance industries. And they, when they recover, they will never be the same.
Yes. These recoveries are short-term blips in what is a long, many-decade trend in this economy towards a service and creative economy. And so the manufacturing economy is not going to be the same as it was. Even if you would like to have a manufacturing job, you need new kinds of training in order to enter the middle class. You need to do some kind of education. And what economists say is, you know, don't look at specific jobs and specific job trends. Look at this broader quality we call adaptability or flexibility. And that's where you'll find the key. And even though the economy has been shouting to men, listen, you need to go to college to get a degree, somehow men are not hearing the message and women are hearing the message.
And you interviewed unemployed men across the country trying to understand why more of them don't go back to school to get the credentials they might need to get new jobs in the fields where the new jobs are. What did they tell you?
In the book, one of my chapters takes place in a town in Alabama, which had been dependent on the single manufacturer and was quite a prosperous town. And what you see is the men and the women effectively switching places, and the women sort of starting at the bottom. You know, they'll take jobs for less money. It's empowering and fun for them because they've never worked before. They are in no sense feminists. They never call themselves feminists. They're really not those kind of women. But the men just have a hard time adjusting because that way of life was so central to their identity. They don't really want to start at the bottom again. They have a pretty fixed sense of what it means to be a man and what a man's job is and what a woman's job is. So it leaves them a little bit stuck, and they don't really know so much how to move forward.
So they're concerned about taking pay cuts and getting jobs that have less prestige.
Yes, which is perfectly understandable. Why would anyone want to take a pay cut? It's just that I guess part of the message of this book and the hopeful message, despite the title, is in future generations, you want a slightly expanded notion of what it means to be a man.
But what happens when you tell these men, well, you're never going to get that job back, so why don't you adjust?
It can go in two ways. So in the book, you see both that it goes in the disastrous way. I mean, you see men really going downhill where they think that that factory life operates almost like a phantom limb for them, you know, or, you know, they still think Elvis is alive. They're just waiting for the day. And there's a scene in which the girlfriend of one of the guys takes him back to the factory just to kind of shove it in his face and tell him, look, it is not coming back. You have to stop talking about it. And there are other situations that work out pretty well where men adjust in one way or another, either to one of these high-tech manufacturing jobs, to computer jobs, or in one case, a man who decides after watching the example of his girlfriend to become a nurse, the man who I start the book with, at the end has this heartwarming scene, which is not going to touch all men. Some men are going to be like, so you're just saying we all should be women and do women's things, you know, but it is what it is, the true story of what happened to this guy.
But you point out that job that economists expect the jobs in the nurturing professions to be the fastest growing in the coming years.
Yes.
So we're talking about nursing and the like.
Yes, yes. We are talking about, I mean, the healthcare industry is one people can say is solidly growing, just like we see the service economy. I mean, it's funny. Basically, what's happening is women are entering the workforce at the upper echelons and thus opening jobs at the lower echelons for things that women used to do for free, like elder care or child care or, you know, taking care of members of the family who are ill. That used to be women's work. And now that a lot more women are working, you know, it's this cascading effect.
Isn't the fact that women still get paid less than men for the same job also a factor here? It's just cheaper to hire a competent woman because you don't have to pay her as much.
Yes. I mean, the wage gap, as we talk about it, is a little exaggerated. It's not quite as big as we think. But I do think that's part of this dynamic, that women will take jobs for less money. And actually, in a chapter that I call The Top, what I talk about is our comfort with women's negotiation, how we think of aggressive and dominant women, and, you know, the fact that women never negotiate for their first salaries. It's a vast difference between how many men negotiate for their starting salaries and how many women do. And given how important women are to this economy, that's one thing I think needs to change.
Are more women than men currently employed in the United States?
So in 2009, we tipped over to more than 50% of women making up the workforce. Since then, it's wavered back and forth. So we could say it's about equal. So sometimes, some months, it's 48% are women, you know, and some are men. Also, the labor statistics are difficult to follow because they don't take into account who's in education and who's on disability. So women are more likely to be out of the workforce because they're in school. And men, increasingly, as we've heard the administration talk about, are increasingly going on disability.
And we now have a situation where 1 in 5 men are unemployed, where it was 1 in 20 in 1950. Despite the disparity in pay, aren't women also bringing in a higher percentage of the family income than ever before?
Yes. Right now, women are about 42% on average, and you have a tremendous number more what we call breadwinner wives who are, you know, who are the breadwinners in their family. And this is a monumental psychic shift in America, although not that well documented. And so one thing I did was interview a lot of these couples.
Well, how does this affect couples generationally? I'd imagine this is much harder for older couples to deal with, a man who was brought up with the idea that a man is the breadwinner in the family. And a younger couple might very well have a very different attitude.
Yes, that's exactly right. We're getting used to it over time. We're really not totally there yet. But when I talk to couples in their 50s in Alabama, you know, I had to really tread delicately. I had to really worry about men's egos, and they knew I was worrying about their egos. And it was a slightly more awkward conversation, especially in a Christian town where head of the household really has a deep spiritual meaning. And when I talk to younger couples, they are getting used to it. They're still, you know, people ask me dating, for example, there's still some awkwardness in dating. If you know the woman makes more money, should she pick up the check? You know, there's all sorts of questions that arise. Is she allowed to suggest a vacation that she knows her boyfriend can't quite afford? It's not like a system that has been around for tens of thousands of years dies without a trace. It's still awkward and uncomfortable. And while men are theoretically on board with women making more money, sometimes they're not always psychically or emotionally on board with that. So,
and you even cite a case where a man is really troubled that his wife makes $15,000 more a year than he does. That's not all that much more money, but it was big to him.
Well, that's why I love this story, because it wasn't all that much more money. He's very progressive. He lives in a big city. He says to me, look, I see the stay-at-home dad in the park. I want that guy to exist. I'm a progressive. Politically, I want that guy to exist. I just don't want to be that guy. It still makes me uncomfortable. So you realize we're not entirely there in terms of, you know, you look at a guy in the park with his kids and are you thinking, what's wrong with that guy? You know, I want us to get over that. I really want us to get over that.
My guest is Hannah Rosin, R-O-S-I-N, a senior editor at The Atlantic, where she first reported on this story, expanded now into a book called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. It is published by Riverhead Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Hannah Rosin. Her book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women, published by Riverhead. Listeners have been writing in. A listener from Brooklyn asks about the impact of race and class.
Class is absolutely crucial to the story. I explicitly divided the book into two class divisions in terms of how this phenomenon of the rise of women is affecting people, because it's not just that it's affecting the different classes in different ways, it's in opposite ways. So for the college educated, you see, for example, that marriages are stronger than ever, I think largely because women don't feel trapped in certain positions and men don't feel trapped as the breadwinner. There's a little more looseness around those roles. And I think for the non-college educated, pretty much marriage is on the decline because women are finding that men are not suitable partners.
Or another listener asks, are attitudes about women being the primary wage earner different in different areas of the country?
Yes. One time I had someone write me and say, you know, what's everyone's problem? I think it's awesome. Everyone thinks it's great that I'm a stay-at-home dad. And then I looked at his sign-off and realized he lived in Portland, Oregon. I thought, that's not what everybody thinks in the country.
And a listener points out that men are stepping in as primary care providers for their children in unprecedented numbers. And that's something you discovered as well. Is this a matter of just having to deal with the reality of the situation, or haven't we also seen changing attitudes about what a man's role might be in a family?
It's a little bit of both. So some men have had to do it, and I think studies show that men who do it by necessity are less happy with their situation than men who choose to be stay-at-home dads. That's a little bit obvious, but that's how it breaks down.
And it seems like the expectations that both sexes hold about traditional gender roles, consciously or subconsciously, still do play a part in keeping men from changing. Were people aware, the people you spoke to, of how their expectations have influenced their behavior?
No, not yet. I think part of the reason I wrote this book is to make people aware of how quickly things are changing and what their sort of old narratives are and their old attitudes and how they need to catch up to the new realities so that our attitudes hopefully will catch up.
And you admit that you found yourself startled to see a stay-at-home dad make T-shirts for his child's preschool child's teachers, then later realized that his actions shouldn't have startled you at all.
Exactly. That's an emotional transition I made in the course of writing this book, is that I had to question, why was I startled? I mean, I know from my research on men and women and how much women are doing both at work and the household that the only way this puzzle can fit together is if men do more at home, and so which I should be applauding him.
Now, this is not just something in this country. You write about a program instituted by the Swedish government to help change attitudes about men taking time off from work to care for their children.
Yes.
Was that effective?
It was effective only when they really forced it and made it mandatory. And so now men have to do it. And it's created what people call this new emotional masculinity. They have different names for it, but it's really forced men to take care of their children for a certain amount of time or they lose money. So now a lot of Swedish men are doing it.
You also write about an initiative to improve workplace safety on offshore oil platforms that involve an effort to change the macho culture that exists on
that. That is one of my absolute favorite studies ever, how they took these super macho men who wouldn't even ask for help when they had to lift very heavy things and it was causing all these accidents. And so they decided the way to solve this problem was to, you know, get them in touch with their feminine side and allow them to ask for help. And by the end, the men were talking in ways that you wouldn't believe compared to how they were talking at the beginning of the study. It was really wonderful.
Could it be that women tend to be more flexible because they are used to being more flexible? They're required in many instances to balance work, housework, childcare, elder care. As a result, their husbands get less of an opportunity to even learn how to multitask in those kinds of areas.
Yes. In my book, I make it very clear that I don't think these are innate traits. I think this is largely cultural. I think this is largely because women
have... It's because of our brains wiring?
You know, I think it must be some relationship between your brain wiring and culture, but I give more of the credit to culture. It's the way those two things interact. I think largely because women have been the underdogs and have been hustling and doing so much stuff that they're able to hustle and do so much stuff, whereas men haven't had to, at least up to this point.
And you also say that women are more likely to return to school to be retrained than men.
Vastly more likely.
So what's happening in our schools today? Are we now seeing more women in the schools than men?
A lot more women. I mean, 60% of bachelor's and master's degree go to women. Women just passed men in PhDs. Women seem to be much better in schools. And it's not just our schools. It's schools almost everywhere in the world where women are graduating at higher rates. And, you know, like it or not, that's a prerequisite to a successful life in America. You pretty much have to have a college degree if you want to climb up into the middle and upper class.
At least if you can get your parents to pay for your college loans.
Exactly. And unless you're Bill Gates, I guess.
One of the most surprising findings you've included in your book concerns the college hookup culture. For anyone not familiar with it, can you explain it to us?
Sure. So hooking up is a term that people use not necessarily to mean sex, but to have some intimacy without a relationship. And I think we have largely looked at women as the victims in this situation. And I turn the tables a little bit in my book by saying just one view on it, but actually women need the hookup culture. It's part of the way they get to have emotional connections in college and in their 20s, but still keep an eye on their careers, which at that point in their life is very important to them.
Were the young women's attitudes about casual sex more like the ones that have been held by young men in the past? Should we see the hookup culture as how some young women feel that they have the same sexual freedom that's always been available to young men?
You know, I will tell you the truth that it felt a little bit like bravado, like a moment, like a feminist moment where women were trying to prove that they had the same sexual attitudes in men. And we see this a lot in our movies, like the movie Bachelorette that came out this week, you know, where women are trash talking in a way that doesn't feel necessarily natural, but in a way that's proving a point, which I think both pop culture and sort of college women are forcing on us and getting us to think about it, even though I don't think that's the place where it's going to ultimately end up.
Well, many of them told you that they avoid getting involved in long-term relationships because they want to focus instead on their classes and careers. And one woman told you that having a boyfriend was like taking another four-credit class and she didn't have the time.
Well, yeah. I mean, I will say that wasn't my study. That was a four-year study. There were these two researchers who camped out in what was called a party dorm for 4 years. And so they got to see the woman evolve over time. So even though they picked up a huge amount of complaining about how the guys were jerks and how the hookup culture was a pain, you know, they also saw over a long period of time that these women kind of needed it and avoided getting into long-term relationships.
Middle class and lower middle class women are now much less likely to marry than in the past.
Much less likely. It's a very different picture than college-educated women. Much less likely to get married.
Didn't some of the women say that a husband would be just another mouth to feed?
You are laughing, but I can't even tell you how many times I heard that line. That's the standard line when I ask people, you know, why aren't you married? Why aren't you married to the father of your children? They would say, oh, he said, just be another mouth. Just be like another child in the house.
And a mother you spoke to in a grocery store who was shopping with her daughter told you she hid food from her daughter's father so that they would have more to eat.
Exactly. I mean, it's infantilizing almost. And I noticed this with college girls that I interviewed at a state school in Kansas City, that when I was in college, we sort of thought of men and women as equal. We'll get married. We'd both be equal partners. But these girls talked about the boys almost like they were another child. And one girl even said that men are the new ball and chain, which I thought was very funny.
You conducted a survey for Slate last year of 7,500 people in female breadwinner couples. And Slate readers tend to be fairly affluent. So
yes.
What were you learning there?
So large majority, about 80%, described themselves as happy in their marriages, although it was mostly the women who tended to answer the survey. But underneath the surface, when I started to interview people, you could see some tension. A marriage model that's existed for thousands of years doesn't die without a ripple. So especially when I interviewed the men, actually the women, some of the women resented being the breadwinner in the same way men over history have resented being the breadwinner. And some of the men had what I would call a masculine mystique, you know, a male version of the feminine mystique, which is to say they were home taking care of the kids or they were domesticated and they felt like, is this really all there is in life?
Well, the statistics indicate a real shift. In 2007, just 60% of the women in their 30s and early 40s were married. In 1970, 84% had gotten married?
Yes, that's due to two different factors. One is that people are waiting longer to get married, and second is that some people are just not getting married at all.
And women also feel freer to divorce, partly because they can support themselves.
Again, this is a class split. So like everything else, a stable marriage is a class luxury in America. So the college-educated don't get divorced that often, and the non-college-educated get divorced at the same rates they did in the 70s.
A listener, Anna, on the Upper West Side writes, "I survived a couple of layoffs by working as a secretary. My purely anecdotal observation is that men aren't as willing to work as administrative assistants, and in any case, they're less likely to be hired, even if they want."
Yes, that's true. The discrimination runs both ways. At some point, I asked the women in Alabama who were fairly successful, "Would you ever hire a man as a receptionist?" And they kind of laughed at that idea. I mean, it just seemed silly to them that a man would be a receptionist. Although they did mention, oh, some of the younger guys come to the hospital and whatnot. So maybe it's a generational thing as well.
You also write about what you have called seesaw marriages. Now, I've known about seesaw marriages since I went to college.
Excellent.
Have things changed?
I didn't know that term existed.
No, I don't marriage. Know if they were yeah. called seesaw marriages. It was, I'll work while you go to school and then you work while I go to school.
Yes, I think it's just that's become more acceptable. I mean, the Obamas have a seesaw marriage. The Bidens have a seesaw marriage where the wife gets to be the breadwinner for some period of time. And when I talk to very young girls, 21 or 22, in one of my chapters about pharmacy school, which is one of the up-and-coming professions for women, they say things like, you know, whoever's the breadwinner at that time. So you really feel like psychologically they've removed the association of breadwinner from male. They just think of breadwinner as a kind of empty role that anybody can step into at any time, and that's very different.
You interviewed one couple, Sarah and Stephen, who had a seesaw marriage. After they got married, didn't Stephen work while Sarah was in law school? What's he doing now that she's working full-time and earning a good salary?
He is going to law school, but also he's a stay-at-home dad, and they have a funny arrangement between them. And people have had interesting reactions to them. You know, some people think he's not doing enough, but he's home taking care of the kids, largely.
But you also say a lot of the family burden still falls on her shoulders.
Well, that's one thing I noticed with women. I call them a slowly expanding colonial empire, which is to say that women don't tend to give up old roles when they take on new roles. So even if they expand in the public sphere and work and earn a lot of money, they still feel control over the private realm, meaning the domestic, their house, basically.
And you say that she's taken on her new role of full swing,
yes,
while he is kind of half-hearted about it.
Yes.
Do you see their arrangement as almost a microcosm of what we've been discussing, women taking on more and more while men are taking on less?
Yes, that's something like what's happening. If you look at time use statistics, you know, women work a lot more than they used to in the 70s, but shockingly, they also do more childcare than they did when they weren't working very much. So I don't really know how that all works, except that many of my friends are exhausted. I mean, it's not a recipe for happiness, you know, it's a recipe for exhaustion.
You've said that your research for this book has inspired you to raise your own two sons differently than you'd planned. What will you do differently?
I already do things differently. It's clear to me that while my son and daughter are equally intelligent and good students, it's much more of a strain on my son than it is on my daughter. What school is demanding comes much more naturally to her. So I try and give him the tools without, you know, doing it for him or forcing the school to change. I try and give him some tools to meet the world as it is.
And maybe we have to try to convince boys that flexibility is a good thing.
Yes, without emasculating them. I really emphasize that since, you know, I don't want boys to leave with the message that they have to be girls, really. That's really not fair. Nor do I want men to leave with the message that they have to be women.
And maybe if people would hire more men as executive secretaries.
That would be great. If people would hire men as nurses, if men would choose to be nurses, awesome. I'm all for it. And then the women can be radio technicians. This would be like the 70s, free to be you and me. We'll all switch
and
places.
Work forklifts.
Exactly.
At Home Depot. Hannah Rosen is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and her latest book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. It is published by Riverhead Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.